we kind of hacked that employer side recruiter information. And so when emergency physicians say you're an emergency physician and you apply through IV for Wilson Medical Center, which is where I do my clinical work now in Eastern North Carolina, it's a team health site. So team health's recruiter starts getting applications through this thing, IV clinicians, and they're free, and the people coming through are really good. They're like, hey, what's this IV clinicians thing? This is really helpful. We then use the physician applicants and applications as our core marketing strategy.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Our live stream today is Monopoly Medicine, the pros and cons of physician practice consolidation. I'm very pleased to have as our guest on the show today, Dr. Leon Edelman. Leon is a fellow Pemba alumnus graduating in 2016 from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. Dr. Edelman is also an emergency medicine physician, the CEO and co-founder of IV Clinicians, and he's also established a community of emergency physician and APPs, emergency medicine providers, really, that he provides content to in the form of a newsletter and has had a podcast in the past. So, Leon, I'm very, very pleased to welcome you to Pemba On Demand today.
Well, Norm, it's an honor to be here, and I love Pemba, so happy to discuss anything Pemba related.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to join us for the show today, and I'm excited to have a conversation with you about your founding IV Clinicians and the work that you're doing in the emergency medicine space. It's going to be an exciting conversation.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
So maybe you could start out by just telling us a little bit about IV Clinicians and what prompted you to start that company and what is the focus of it?
Yeah, so IV Clinicians is a marketplace simplifying the emergency medicine job search through transparency. The company basically came out of years and years of saying somebody should do this, right? So I finished residency and I looked for my first job, and this was in 2011. I was looking for jobs in the DC area, and I figured, you know, you could just sort of pull up a list through Google or whatever of emergency medicine practices within driving distance of Washington, DC. And there was nothing there in 2011. And then I moved to Nashville, you know, 5-6 years later, still nothing there. Then I was a medical director and wanted to, you know, it was a challenge to recruit. So I wanted to be on, or I wanted our emergency department and our practice to be on wherever it was that these physicians were searching for jobs, and there was still nothing there. And so in 2021, after watching what was happening on the nursing side, so lots of really innovative nursing staffing tech companies growing rapidly during the pandemic, so watching that, I was like, finally, it's time to be the person that creates this. And we jumped in, created the business August of 2021, and we've been growing ever since.
Great. So when you started this, did you market this to emergency providers to sign up, or did you look at employers to post jobs on your website, or a combination?
Yeah, great question. So with any marketplace, there's this chicken and egg problem, right? So we're not selling a product. We're not really selling a service. What we're selling is the connection to the other side of the market, which means that you have to have the other side of the market there for the first side to want to be there. And so we had a few hypotheses. One is the doctors were the harder side of the market and the more valuable side of the market. They're the fish, if you will, and the recruiters are the fishermen, fisher people. And so, so we had to figure out a way to get the doctors there. And the thing that we were trying to build for the doctors is this map of emergency medicine. So connecting every emergency department to its emergency medicine employer, which had never been done, but then connecting the employer to the recruiter. So what we knew we couldn't do is connect with all, there are 5,700 ERs in the country, connect with the in-house recruiters for 5,700 ERs and get them to be there, right? So we had to hack that and spend a kind of ridiculous amount of time getting the identification and then email addresses of every in-house emergency medicine in-house recruiter in the country. And so we kind of hacked that side of the market, and then that started bringing in the physicians who could then apply to jobs at any emergency department.
So how long, you mentioned that was a pretty lengthy process. How long did it take you, and how did you actually find the resource to get the contact information for those recruiters?
Yeah, so when I started Ivy, I told my wife, I was like, well, you know, in 6 months, we should be, you know, raising all this money, and then we're going to do this in 12 months, and we should be, you know, profitable shortly thereafter. Nothing in startup land goes like that, right? So everything is slower than we want it to be. We're still gathering data 2 years, 2.5 years on this. And that's because things keep changing, right? So we're going to talk a decent amount about this, but like American Physician Partners, 130 emergency departments, goes bankrupt or ceases operations with 2 weeks notice. Envision goes bankrupt, and now they're dropping sites, all their sites in California, and they're giving up their small rural emergency departments that weren't making money, and HCA is in-housing their Envision sites, but not all their Envision sites. And so to keep up with all this data is a massive operation.
So has your process changed as you've grown over the last 3 years? Are you providing a subscription for the provider side and just using public domain information for the recruiting side, or have you now started to find some companies or recruiting firms that are paying for access to your database?
Yeah, good question. So the good news with marketplaces is that they build on network effects. So at the beginning, we had to hack all this together, and the best way to describe the process was data janitorial work, where it was not any more glamorous than spending an inordinate amount of time on Google and various strategies of getting one by one information. But then when we got 95% correct for, say, a practice like Vituity, they didn't want to be 95% correct. They want to be 100% correct because we are kind of a front door to their practice, right? And so they want everything to be correct. So then they started feeding us information, and several large groups are already doing that, and more every week. On the physician side, there's also network effects in that physicians see Ivy, realize that it's the best way to find information about emergency medicine practices, and then share that information. That's how we're growing. We're growing organically there, but they also give us feedback about things like salaries. We have over 1,000 physician entered salaries in our database. And so we get lots and lots of information from our customers on both sides of the market.
Okay. So you mentioned you had some plans when you did the startup in terms of when you would turn the corner in terms of profitability. You've been live now for 3 years. I guess I have a couple of questions around that. Mm-hmm. Number one is, when you started this up, did you plan for this to be a revenue stream that would replace your revenue from practicing as an emergency physician?
So the goal is always to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, right? Like that's how it works. So you build a platform, and then you pivot once or twice, and then you sell for $1 billion. Right, so that's
so wait, are you planning on adding a dating app in here?
Right. So unfortunately, back here in the real world, it never, if you're not Instagram, that's not how it goes. And so what is kind of the path if we succeed, right? Still, the most likely outcome is zero, right? So any new tech business, until you are pretty far along, the most likely outcome is going zero. But the plan is month over month growth, so up in all the charts are up and to the right, and then at some point the plan would be to sell to a larger entity and be part of that, because we've taken investment along the way, and so the goal, both in order to build the business to be more at scale, but also to pay back our investors, is to have a liquidity event. And usually that's a 5 to 9 year type of trajectory.
And have you had to change that projection since you started? When you started, was the plan to have a 5 year liquidation strategy, and you've had to push that out because of the rate of development, or has that maintained? Have you been pretty consistent with that goal?
No, five to 10 years is other people's timeline, not ours. We were going to be 1 year.
Oh, I see.
Right? We had this all figured out, right?
So, back to the Mark Zuckerberg approach.
Yeah, right. But that's not, you have to be vaguely, you have to be somewhat delusional to jump into entrepreneurship while half of your brain is also like super realist on like the tactical objectives that have to be done today in order to survive till tomorrow. But yeah, the longer that we've been at it, the more we realize we're just like everybody else, and we really are on a 7-ish year.
Okay. What has been the biggest change in your business plan? We all start out, as you've alluded to several times, I think very, very well, that we all start out with an idea, and it's kind of like Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And have you been punched in the face with this business? Have there been assumptions or ideas that you had that just never really came to fruition? And maybe you could talk about some of those and how you dealt with that.
Oh, yeah. So the biggest one was our whole business model, right? So we kind of trapped ourselves with our business model in that recruiting sites, whether it's a job board or a company like Weatherby or Jackson Coker, the hirer of doctors pays for the hiring of that doctor, right? So the employer would pay the firm or would pay the job board. And so that was always the assumption. We would charge for value create. Well, we got a few contracts, and then we realized that doesn't make sense with what we're building, because the service that we are providing for the doctors on one side of the market is that we have all of the emergency medicine jobs. So every emergency department, every group, every job is on Ivy. Well, if we start charging for access, so if, say, Team Health is on Ivy, but because they're paying to be on Ivy, but Envision isn't on Ivy because they're not paying to be on Ivy, well, now do we have a platform that's all the emergency medicine jobs without Envision? That doesn't make any sense. And so we had to totally like etch-a-sketch our business model, because the hard side of the market is the doctors. We've always had our true north to provide the right service to the doctors. And so we had to totally scrap our business model. And we've gone, we're actually still free for both sides of the market. We're finally going to be charging for job posts in a freemium type of a model, starting mid-June. Finally, okay. There, two and a half years into this.
Okay. All right. So you're not charging the physicians or the providers right now for access to the job boards.
Correct. Yeah, I still don't think we'll ever want to charge the doctor side, because they are, we want to lower the barrier to entry for the hard side of the market. So like on Zillow, it'll be a little bit it'd be unexpected for the house hunter to have to pay to access all of the houses. The way that Zillow makes its money is by realtors paying to be there, and they actually make a lot of their money off of mortgage loan origination. But it's all stuff from the business side, not the individual.
Okay. So you've got two customer bases, or maybe three, right? You have health systems that have their own ER groups. You have the large emergency management corporations, and large and small. And then you have the providers who are currently looking for jobs. So how do you market to those three different customer bases? Where do you go to find the people looking for jobs? Where do you go for the people with the jobs? You mentioned your early strategy, but has that changed over the course of the last 3 years?
Right. And how do we do it with essentially $0?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So not an easy, I would love to hire Amy Cathy and come up with our marketing strategy. We've essentially had to become the news, right? So to be out there without paying to be out there, we have to organically build something that gets people's attention. Mm-hmm. On the physician side, that turned into the Emergency Medicine Workforce newsletter, which I write about every 2 to 3 weeks about the business of emergency medicine. And I post a lot on LinkedIn. I try to get the message out about the business of emergency medicine. And what that does is creates a brand of Leon Edelman, which then people are like, oh, Leon Edelman. And then they connect the brand of Leon Edelman to the brand of IV clinicians, hopefully. And then they go to IV clinicians and then they realize, hey, this is a really cool platform to find jobs. And they tell their friends about it. And that's our core marketing strategy on the physician side. We've also done things like send an IV branded chocolate bar to every emergency medicine resident in the United States. We did that, and it seemed to work. There are companies that do that for like $3 a chocolate bar, so that was cool. Mm-hmm. But again, that costs real money.
Right.
On the employer side, it's basically our strategy is using applications as our core marketing tool. Like I was describing before, we kind of hacked that employer side recruiter information. And so when emergency physicians say you're an emergency physician and you apply through IV for Wilson Medical Center, which is where I do my clinical work now in Eastern North Carolina, it's a team health site. So team health recruiter starts getting applications through this thing, IV clinicians, and they're free, and the people coming through are really good. They're like, hey, what's this IV clinicians thing? This is really helpful. And we then use the physician applicants and applications as our core marketing strategy.
So when you were starting up your business, I noticed that you're the co-founder of IV clinicians. How did you find the person that co-founded the company with you? Was that a long-standing relationship that you had? Maybe talk to me a little bit about, or talk to us a little bit about how that whole relationship developed and led to founding IV clinicians.
Yeah, I have to say, finding Matt is like a freaking godsend. This would not have worked if Matt and I had not connected. So one of the funny stories in getting this started was I had this idea. I wrote our 25-page business plan that has very little to do with what we are doing now, because all business plans change a lot once you actually start implementing it. But so I had this plan. And I started meeting with people in the software world because I knew a decent amount about emergency medicine. I didn't know almost nothing about building a software company or a marketplace or anything like that. So I started meeting with everybody that I could in the Raleigh-Durham area. And one of the pieces of advice that I got was, so I was at lunch with this guy who had sold his HR tech company, and he says, make sure not to bring in an old chief technology officer. I was like, so this guy's about 30. I was like, what do you mean by old? And he says, like, I don't know, 40? And here I am, 42 years old. And I'm like, we definitely have different ideas of what old means. And the reason that he was saying that was a company like what I was trying to create really can't afford a successful 40-year-old software engineer, right? And so if you hire a 40-year-old who's willing to work with me, they're going to be an unsuccessful 40-year-old. You don't want an unsuccessful 40-year-old. You want a yet-to-be-discovered 25-year-old who is looking to build their you know, second companies. And so I happened to meet Matt Simpson, my co-founder. We went to the same school, same high school, except he was about 2 years old when I graduated high school. And it's been great. He is he's an amazing software developer and really is a great leader of people. And what that's allowed us to do is build the company in parallel while working closely together. So I have no idea how he creates what he creates. He has no idea of what the market of emergency medicine should look like. And so we don't step on each other's toes while we build the two sides of this company.
Okay. So was this an introduction that someone gave you to him?
Yeah. So one of the people that I met with in this whole, like, trying to get as much information as possible early on about building a software company turned out to be his roommate. So I had lunch with the roommate, introduced me to Matt, and then we had lunch once. And then we had lunch a second time. He brought his resume. I was like, oh, wow. I guess this is like an interview or something. And so, So we realized that he was looking for somebody with market expertise, somebody old like me who could help build a business. And I was looking for somebody like him who could turn ideas into actual software and products on the web.
Great. Well, that sounds like it worked out very, very well then, fortuitously. The way you were going about researching the whole process led to a connection, it sounds like.
I was really lucky. One of the themes of our business has been every time we've worked with an agency, like a development shop, it's been a disaster. So having people in-house really has been our key to success. We've really only succeeded with in-house folks and people doing very specific jobs for us, not agencies.
So you mentioned your, I'd like to maybe pivot a little bit here. You mentioned your emergency medicine workforce newsletter, and I know we talked in preparation for the show that you have had several different ways to reaching out to the workforce. One was you started doing a podcast, and I know you had a podcast for both physicians and advanced practice professionals. But now it sounds like you're focusing pretty much on the newsletter to communicate ideas and topics that are germane to the workforce. Tell me a little bit about how that all came about, and I'm interested in moving into the conversation about that we're going to be talking about in terms of the issues going on in the healthcare space right now with private equity and all those kinds of things coming into the space in ways that we've never seen in the past.
Yeah, so pretty quickly after starting Ivy, we realized a few things. One is that we have data that just wasn't out there before, and so we wanted to share that data with the broader community. And the other is that the emergency medicine business, the business of emergency medicine is just fascinating. There's so many little angles to dig into and find information about things like the American Physician Partners bankruptcy and Envision bankruptcy and the challenges that the organizations within emergency medicine like ASAP and AEM and EMRA have had over the last year or two really have been fascinating to dig into. And basically the newsletter is me exploring one topic to a significant depth and then sharing that with the broader community and sharing it in a way that the perspective is always from the perspective of a working doctor so that they can have a better sense of the business that they're in.
So when did you start the newsletter?
been about a year, year and a half at this point.
And how big is your circulation right now?
So I get between 5,000 and 15,000 reads per newsletter. We have about 3,000 subscribers to the newsletter. And all that's coordinated through Substack, which makes it really easy.
So when you say a subscriber, there's a monthly or annual fee to join the newsletter as a subscriber?
So it's free. Until a few weeks ago, it was free for everybody. And until my wife told me one last time, she was like, you can't be giving this away for free forever. I was like, well, I just want as broad of a reach as possible. And so now the setting on Substack is there's a free option, but there's an option to pay. The lowest rate on Substack is $5 per month or $30 per year. So that's the paid option.
What kind of reaction did you get when you made that change?
It's still an optional free thing. Yeah. So I have been getting more paid subscribers, and so that really is validation. You can click something for free, and that's nice, but really getting paid for the work is much more validating.
Yeah, I had a friend who started up a community, and she was very successful. She formed a community, and it's grown to 46,000 members. And she was doing it for free for about 5 years. And she started to offer membership in the community, or requiring membership in the community, for $10 a year. And she was surprised by the amount of negative feedback from people over such a nominal amount. And I just wondered if you had experienced anything like that, or by keeping a free option, you feel like you might have averted some of that criticism.
So, yes, I think that's one thing that Substack does nicely by keeping the free option. But it does remind me of one of the great podcasts of all time, which was this Planet Money on why World War II veterans hate Red Cross.
Okay.
So apparently, if you ask World War II veterans about the Red Cross, they don't like it. They're like, how do you hate the Red Cross? Well, the answer was, for the first like 2 or 3 years of the war, the Red Cross gave out free donuts. So there's free donuts. The Red Cross was the free donut group. That was the connection. And then they started charging like a tiny nominal amount, and people got pissed. They got super pissed that they would have to pay for their donuts. And so the moral of the story basically is, going from free, like training people that something is worth $0, it is really hard to go from $0 to not $0 without annoying them. It's better to start with a low number and then rise from there rather than zero.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think that's it's a mindset we get into, that something's available for nothing, and that's what we want to take advantage of forever. So, this podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So let's talk a little bit about the issue that you briefly mentioned. And the topic of the show today is, the physician practice consolidation. Basically, we're seeing a lot of examples across many segments of healthcare industry where private equity is kind of flowing into healthcare. I was just looking on MedPage Today yesterday, and there was an article with Lisa Kahn, who's the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, and she was talking about how the FTC is really beginning to focus on private equity companies that are investing in healthcare. And she referenced an anesthesia monopoly, quote unquote, where they were actually suing an anesthesia company under the Federal Trade Commission rules and regulations. Is that similar to what we're seeing in emergency medicine, or are you familiar with that anesthesia case at all?
Yeah, that case is fascinating. And one of the nice things about it is that it makes public what otherwise would be private discussions in a boardroom somewhere that those of us on the outside would never hear. And so the case is FTC versus U.S. Anesthesia Partners and Welsh Carson, though just last week, Welsh Carson, a judge dismissed Welsh Carson from the case, mostly because Welsh Carson, which is the private equity investor / owner of U.S. Anesthesia Partners, is actually a minority owner and owns and has a minority of the seats on the U.S. Anesthesia Partners board. And so the judge basically said, we can't prove that this minority owner is fully liable for the behavior of the portfolio company, U.S. Anesthesia Partners. So it's basically FTC versus U.S. Anesthesia Partners. Well, what did U.S. Anesthesia Partners do that led to this lawsuit, or what are they alleged to have been doing? The first step was consolidating the several markets within Texas. So the strategy was buy a large anesthesia practice within these metro areas, and then build from there. And so they would acquire other anesthesia groups within the market. By doing that, they kept raising their power vis-a-vis the insurers, because they were bigger and bigger and bigger. And so each new practice could come in and raise their rates more compared to how they had been negotiating their rates prior to joining U.S. Anesthesia Partners. And then you end up with a group that controls more than 50%, significantly more than 50% of some of these metro areas. Where they kind of went past the line from just sort of scaling up a business, right? So we all know about health systems that have more than 50% of the market in their region. That's certainly far from unheard of. What they did that led to the lawsuit was colluded with other anesthesia groups to not compete against each other, and colluded with them on pricing with insurers. They also, within lawsuits like this, there are always some like emails where it's like, I can't believe they said that. What, there's like an email from an executive that was titled "Cha-ching" about how they were going to wring money out from the insurers. And then the lawsuit talks in a lot of detail what their strategy was to raise rates from insurers. Basically what they would do is they would say, we do not want to go out of network. We're not like, Envision used to be, where the strategy was just be out of network and send balance bills to directly to patients. We don't want to do that. We want to stay in network, but we are going to negotiate for a very high rate. And if you, the insurance company, do not agree to our very high rate, we will go out of network. And the theory was they had a dominant enough market position that patients would be so mad at the insurance company for not being in network with most of the anesthesiologists within that metro area, that the patients would essentially force the insurer to go back in network, and then they would have a negotiated rate that was super high.
So they, unlike some of the emergency management companies, were using the threat of going out of network as their negotiating ploy.
Correct.
So you mentioned the word pricing as well. Now, pricing in healthcare is different than pricing in a lot of other industries, right? If I go into a car dealership and I say, what's the price of that vehicle? And we negotiate the price, I usually end up writing a check in one form or another for that price. But healthcare is not built that way. And there are some insurance companies, mainly governmental insurance companies, where our price that we charge has nothing to do with what that insurance company will pay us. And that is true for commercial insurances too. So talk to me a little bit about that. How high did this U.S. anesthesia company have to raise their charges in order to get the impact on their revenue that they were looking for?
So in the lawsuit, there are redactions. And so numbers like that are redacted from the lawsuit. So I don't know the exact number. So I don't have that exact number for you. But what I can say is that the prices actually paid, like you're saying, have nothing to do with price, list price. Healthcare is much more like a Middle Eastern bazaar where prices are flying here, there, and everywhere, and you're not really sure what you're going to end up paying for that rug. That's more like healthcare.
Right. So most companies, when they're charging the payers, even when we charge Medicare, right, we talk about what percentage of Medicare are we charging? And in some cases, that can be 200% of Medicare. It can be 250% of Medicare. Be interesting to know how high they were able to push their charges as a percentage of what the allowable Medicare reimbursement was to some of these companies based on this strategy that they had.
The one peg or one data point that we can point to now because of the No Surprises Act is that the federal government releases the results of arbitration for the No Surprises Act. And provider organizations arbitrating over professional fees are winning at a rate of 70-75% when they're in arbitration versus the insurers. They're winning the vast majority of the time. And most of the average payment in No Surprises Act arbitration is about 2.5 times Medicare, which is higher than average in-network rates. So the providers are actually doing pretty well through arbitration. That being said, arbitration has some massive problems, structural problems, because of the way it was set up through the No Surprises Act. One is the timing. So there isn't, as far as I can tell, any enforcement of insurers having to actually, once there's a decision, oh, you owe $1,000 for this level 5 visit or whatever it is, that they actually pay that. So payment has been both. The decision causes a delay, but then the payment gets delayed. So there's a large time factor. There's also cost to arbitration for each of these cases. So it's an administrative headache, but doctors are winning arbitration and winning at a significantly higher rate than they otherwise would in negotiation with the insurer.
So the No Surprises Act came out, what, 2 years ago now? Year and a half ago?
Yeah. It went live January 1st, 2022.
Okay. So it's been about a year and a half since it's gone into effect. What are the main specialties that were impacted by the No Surprises Act? And does it really prohibit these companies or individual physicians from going out of network?
Yeah, so No Surprises Act was designed for non-shoppable services within healthcare. So it's mostly emergency medicine, anesthesia, radiology, some surgical codes that are involved in the No Surprises Act, with emergency medicine being the most commonly arbitrated specialty.
Okay. So can you tell us, or is there a way to know for us to know what the impact to these has been on revenue for emergency medicine, let's say, or anesthesia, if you compare what their average revenue per patient was prior to No Surprises Act versus after? Is there data out there that tells us, or do we have to kind of make some assumptions about how big the impact has been? I know you mentioned there's two emergency management companies that have gone bankrupt since No Surprises Act. So it's clear that that may have played a role, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that as to how big of a role this change in legislation had.
Yeah, it's been a massive disruptor to the emergency medicine employer landscape. Envision was kind of the poster child of out-of-network billing, or the New York Times article that said, this is the company that does most of the balance billing. They really were the poster child. The average KFF data looking at this in the 2018 type time frame, the average for the whole country was about 18% of emergency medicine bills were out of network. Envision was more like 60-70%. So when basically their business model was built on going at it. So when the No Surprises Act went into effect, it was a massive hit for Envision, and in May 2023, Envision went bankrupt. The next one down was American Physician Partners. So American Physician Partners, there's a slide deck that's still on the internet somehow of their like last ditch effort to raise money before they went bankrupt. All their financials are now public through this slide deck. And in that deck, they say that about 30% of their revenue prior, so November 2021, so prior to the No Surprises Act going into effect, about 30% of their revenue was from out-of-network billing. Mm-hmm. And so when, and even then they were still losing money. It's really like an unbelievably, to lose that much money in acute care medicine before the No Surprises Act while being out of network at that level is kind of mind-boggling, but they did it somehow. So they were out of network and losing money, and then No Surprises Act happens and they just ran out of money and never really had it, as far as I could tell, never really had a plan for how they were going to make it.
Interesting. So at least in those two cases, they were both heavily dependent upon out-of-network billing in those two companies. Are they outliers as compared to the rest of the emergency management companies out there today?
So the flip side is SCP Health, which used to be called Schumacher Clinical Partners. That's what the SCP comes from. So SCP is actually in really strong financial shape. They don't have a huge amount of debt comparatively. Their leverage is like 5x. They were largely out of network as well. What was different with them is, first of all, they adjusted quickly. They decreased a lot of administrative overhead, but also were really aggressive in No Surprises Act arbitration, and they've won 90% of their arbitration cases. So they were really aggressive, really early, and have kept that ship afloat by using arbitration. It is doable to adjust from previously having a out of network strategy to a post No Surprises Act world without going bankrupt. Then there are others who didn't have any debt, and so they were maximally able to adjust because they could adjust salaries, and that's all they had to do. They adjusted the inflow and outflow and kept going. So Vituity is the largest group in emergency medicine that did not take on debt to grow.
Okay. So, and you mentioned that SCP had a 5X. Maybe explain that a little bit to people in the audience who don't understand what a 5X debt ratio is, I think it's called.
Yeah. So the it's the ratio of debt to earnings. And so if you have a large multiple, it means that your ability to pay off that debt with the earnings that you have is diminished. So like right now, at least as of the last analysis by the ratings agencies, Sound Physician has a 23x leverage, whereas SCP is at 5. And so SCP is much better able to pay off its debt than Sound Physician.
So what are the forces that take two companies that are providing the same service in the healthcare industry? Why is one leveraged 23x? Why is the other leveraged 5x? What are their, besides their billing practices, what allows them to be at such a low leverage level? What do they do differently?
That's a good question. And each of these private equity owned companies kind of has a little twist to the business model. Sound has gotten itself into trouble, partly just by taking on a lot of debt, but also on the revenue side, their core business is the hospitalist business. And anybody on the physician side knows the hospitalist business is a terrible business. It has really low margins. Their revenue is really low. The hospitalists generate way more money for the hospital than is accounted for in the actual billing under their names. They're super valuable, but they don't actually generate revenue for themselves. And so, so if you combine a lot of debt placed on the company, and it was placed on Sound from the outside, right? So Sound is owned by Summit Partners, which is a private equity company, and by Optum, which is the subsidiary of United Health. They choose how much debt to place on these on their portfolio companies, and they place just way more debt on Sound than it seems is doable.
So are all of the major companies, Team Health, SCP, Sound, you mentioned those three, Vituity, are they all owned by private equity firms?
So the ones that are left that are private equity owned in emergency medicine are Team Health, SCP, and Sound. Emergency Care Partners has a minority investment by a private equity company, but their physicians own the majority of that company. Envision was owned by KKR, but KKR lost all of its equity in the bankruptcy process. So Envision now is owned by the lenders to KKR. So it's just a bunch of banks. U.S. Acute Care Solutions is about 95% owned by physicians, and Vituity is 100% owned by their physicians.
Okay. So the physicians are basically the investors in those examples, U.S. Acute Care and Vituity?
Correct. However, they are kind of two sides to a coin. So Vituity is physician-owned, physician-run, no debt. They're privately held by their doctors. It is basically a traditional emergency medicine group at scale with some idiosyncrasies, like how you get from one level of partnership to another. U.S. Acute Care Solutions, there's a reason that their name sounds like U.S. Anesthesia Partners. It was started by the same private equity company, Welsh Carson, with, there are quotes by the person at Welsh Carson who started both of them, basically saying, we're going to use the same playbook. So the difference though is in 2021, the physicians bought out Welsh Carson, the physicians at USACS bought out Welsh Carson. So now they have 95% equity ownership. Well, you don't buy out private equity for nothing, right? They had to take a lot of debt and some creative debt in order to pull that off. And so U.S. Acute Care Solutions now has $1.6 billion in debt. And it's debt that has interest rates of around 10%. And so That's a big number.
It is. What's the size of US Care Solutions? How many physicians or providers do they have in their company? Do you know?
So they, on their website, they say they have about 6,000 providers.
Okay. So getting back to the number of providers, so the Envision bankruptcy and the APP bankruptcy, how many providers did that impact?
So the APP bankruptcy impacted 2,500 providers, mostly emergency medicine, but some hospitals and critical care. I honestly do not know the size of that Envision was, but it is rapidly shrinking.
And was it larger than APP? Did they have more contracts and more physicians or more providers?
Oh yeah. So when Envision was bought by KKR, they were bought for $9.9 billion. I mean, this is a massive organization.
And what was their, when you look at the debt per physician, is there a comparison across, you mentioned different debt levels. So what did Envision look like at the time it went bankrupt in terms of its debt ratio, not to earnings, but to the number of providers they employed?
That's a good question. I don't have that, but one thing that did come out in the bankruptcy was that when KKR bought Envision, they put $7 billion of debt on the company, right? So mm-hmm. KKR didn't put a huge amount of their own cash into this purchase. It was almost all debt. And then that debt was put on the portfolio company, not on KKR. Well, when this was 2018, they go bankrupt 5 years later, the company had $7.7 billion in debt as of when they went bankrupt. Hmm. And so not only were they not able to pay down any of their $7 billion debt in 5 years, their debt increased over that 5 years. And most of that time, they were billing out of network, right? They were doing their thing until January 1st, 2022. And so what that tells you is that most likely there was a lot of extraction going on, right? So it's mm-hmm. not that ER doctors and hospitalists were making so much money that Envision couldn't support those salaries. It was, I mean, there's some executive layers of executive compensation that was part of it, but a lot of it is extraction by the private equity company, right? So once KKR owns Envision, they can extract whatever they want, right? They can give themselves what they call dividends, which basically KKR has a meeting of their portfolio managers and they vote and they're like, we're going to take money out of this business and give it to ourselves. You're totally allowed to do that because they own the company.
Yeah. So we have a situation where two of the largest emergency medicine management firms go bankrupt. They put, assuming that APP and Envision were the same size, they would have put about 5,000 providers out on the market. And I know from talking to various providers that obviously the hospitals still needed the providers to provide the emergency medicine care. And they either brought in another contracting group to manage those physicians and providers, or they hired them themselves. But how has these two bankruptcies, how have they impacted, from what you've seen, the physicians who are currently working for companies who are highly leveraged in that way, now that the No Surprises Act is there? Are you seeing an impact on your IV clinicians business? Are more people seeking jobs outside of those large, heavily leveraged companies?
So this is another yes, however. So the market for independent physicians or locum tenens physicians is growing rapidly. So 7 to 10% increase year over year in the locum tenens market. So that's telling you, you know, there are more doctors looking to just sort of be out from any contract management group. The percentage of the market employed by the large staffing firms hasn't gone down. So most of APP's contracts went to other big staffing firms like SEP and Team Health. You're right that a few like now HCA, but before CHS, a few of them in-house their staffing, but mostly it was just the other bigs getting bigger.
Interesting. I would have thought maybe there was a little bit more of an impact, but I didn't know. That's interesting. Of course.
Yeah, it all depends on how you define U.S. acute care solutions, right? So they're physician-owned but largely indebted. They are the fastest, now that APP is bankrupt, U.S. acute care solutions is the fastest growing mm-hmm. emergency medicine group, really along with SEP. SEP is growing quite rapidly as well.
So into any vacuum, there will be growth, right? It's just I wasn't sure whether they would be, whether even the hospitals that were impacted by APP's bankruptcy, I mean, they were only given 2 weeks notice. And I would imagine that some of the leadership in those organizations must have been significantly concerned about signing a contract with another company that could be a deja vu event for them.
So yes, you could imagine that these, you know, 130 or so hospital CEOs who had to staff their ER 2.5 weeks after being told that their staffing firm was going to cease operations went into panic mode. But emergency medicine is a competitive market, and there were plenty of companies willing to pick up those mm-hmm. contracts. U.S. Acute Care Solutions got most of their contracts within that first weekend. They were ready to go. They presumably had some inkling that this was going to happen. And within 2 days, bam, they had 18 new contracts. Those that were less sure of a stable new company coming in, like CHS has mostly rural southern hospitals, they decided it was safer not to outsource and did the insourcing thing. A lot of people are thinking that is basically, it was buying time to make sure that they could staff their ERs, and then there's a decent chance that they'll put those contracts up for bid again.
Interesting. Well, we covered a lot of territory today. I know it's already 1 o'clock. It went by very, very quickly. This was a great discussion. I'd like to take a few minutes, even though we're going to go over the 1 o'clock time, to ask you about your MBA experience. You completed your MBA in 2016 and then started this business up in 2021. When you began the PEMBA program in 2016, was it with the idea that you were going to enhance your entrepreneurial skills? What was the motivation at that time, at that point in your career, for pursuing an MBA?
Yeah, so not at all, actually. So I had no inkling of going into entrepreneurship. The plan was always to find a group an emergency medicine or multi-specialty group that I could become a partner of, and then, you know, grow over time with the group and, you know, just do my doctor leadership management thing. And PEMBA was the way to get the skills necessary to help that group grow and make myself valuable within that organization. Well, the group that I was with when I went to PEMBA, the senior partner sold out to private equity, and then was a medical director with another private group, and APP took all of the contracts within our state for CHS, and so that group was no longer an option for me as the medical director. And so what PEMBA allowed me to do was then pivot my own business strategy from using the PEMBA skills on behalf of a bigger group to starting my own thing and build a company from scratch.
So did you realize that you'd needed those entrepreneurial skills by the end of your MBA or several years later?
Several years later, yeah.
Okay.
I tried the join a group and be partner and grow three times, and each time partnership disappeared for structural reasons.
Okay.
So if you're in the market, if you're like in a place and three times in a row, it's like, wait a second, this thing has disappeared three times in a row. It's time to try something else. And so what Pemba allowed me and allows the graduates to do is, you know, when the cheese gets moved, so to speak, and it always does, right? Things always change. Obstacles are always put in front of you. Pemba allows you to have the skills to figure out the next thing.
Great. And just one last question. I like to ask this to any of the alumni that I interview, but what is your favorite memory of Pemba? What did you enjoy the most? What do you look back on with and think about more often than anything else?
So I have two answers. One is Tom Brown. Tom is an amazing, amazing, amazing man who there are all kinds of great people at Pemba, but Tom really holds it together. And for those who don't know, Tom is the administrative glue of Pemba. He's not a professor, but he does everything else. And then it was my cohort. We were called the Royales. Any productive thing, we were always the worst. We came in last in anything that could be measured. And yet we learned a ton from each other and had a great time.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you again for joining us on our Pemba On Demand live stream. I appreciate you being here and taking out time. It sounds like you have a very busy schedule between your writing and running the business and that kind of thing. So I really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.